You're listening to a Radio 1 91 FM podcast.
We've got an author, Mark Foreman, who has recently done a biography about Tony Fomerson, who is a New Zealand painter, very, very acclaimed artist, and a really, really interesting character that this biography explores a lot of. Morena, Mark, how are you doing?
Morning. I'm very good, thank you, Zach. Thanks for having me on the show.
Of course. It sounds like you've had a very good morning. You walked your dogs through the park, you said?
Walked the dogs through the park up at Cornwall Park. I'm up here in Auckland, Onehunga, and it's a pretty nice morning up here. It was a long, hot summer, and it's just started to cool down a bit now up here, which is quite nice.
That's awesome. That's fantastic. That's probably fantastic. You know, I've kind of been like not a little bit in the periphery of New Zealand art stuff. You know, I used to really go to galleries all the time. I used to host an arts themed show here on Radio 1 before I did breakfast, and I never heard of Tony before. You know, what kind of place does he occupy in the kind of legacy New Zealand artist pantheon? Because I do hear him be kind of mentioned with names like, you know, Con McCown or Gordon Walters or Rita Angus. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Good observation. I think he would be, you know, if you were going to do some kind of ridiculous ranking of New Zealand artists, he would certainly be in our top five artists. And you're right, he is up there now with McCann and Rita Angus and Toss Woolliston, ones like that. Mm. And he made his career was really from the heart of it was in the 70s and 80s. Mm. And that's when he was doing his really big stuff. That's when he got noticed. I think he would be considered now one of our great painters. I think one of the things that people say about him is that he was just really singular in what he painted. You know, he was his own man. Mm. He didn't follow trends and fashions at a time when New Zealand art was kind of going more in an abstract direction, less figurative, and there was lots of color. Mm-hmm. Tony was doing these sort of strange, slightly deformed figures, and they were very muted and sepia toned, and so he stuck at that, and he kind of, now people recognize the Fomerson work because it was so distinctive. He was able to, you know, do his own thing and share his own vision for the world, and I think that's one of the reasons. There's lots of reasons I could go on about, but that's one of the reasons, I think, that he is regarded as one of our greats.
Mm, totally. The book opens with, you know, Fomerson's death and the immediate retrospective on his work that happened in the 90s, and kind of laments the pretentious academic and inaccessible artist biographies that came out of the art history sector in 1990s New Zealand. And you're trying to get away from that noise and present a more raw, you know, a more raw, honest portrayal of the artist as a fallible human. You know, what did you find in the 90s retrospectives that, you know, didn't kind of fit with your idea of Tony, and how has your biography added to our understanding of him?
Mm. Yeah, the 90s, I think, in academia were this time when there was this kind of move towards post-structuralism and that kind of way of reading texts and paintings. And I mean, I would say that the retrospective you're talking about by Ian Whetty was a wonderful thing and brought together all of his paintings, which had never been done before. So that was great. And there are some great essays in the book. But I just felt that the tone was too distant and really didn't. One of the observations that people made about the book was that it was a wonderful account of the art, but there wasn't so much about the life, you know. And he was known as a very, he was, as you've said, he was a character. He had an extraordinary life, you know. He went to prison twice, once in Paris, once in Christchurch. He was an addict. He was on morphine, but got off that. He was an alcoholic. So there are all these parts of his life which people kind of knew about but didn't really talk about. And sometimes I think there is a tendency with biographies, not all, to sort of just look at the art and not think about the context of art. Who was this person who created it? So that's what I wanted to try and do in this book. And people who have read it already have said that it does have a kind of more of a textured, layered feel to it, because I've interviewed around 120 people, not all of whom knew Tony, but many of whom knew Tony really well.
Mm.
And so, you know, they gave me some incredible stories and just very personal observations about him as a person. And I think all of that gives you more of a feel for who the person actually was or is. And, you know, I wanted to try and get beneath the myths that had been shared about Tony Fomerson. Because he sort of cultivated that in a way, this pose he struck.
Yeah.
And I wanted to try and, yeah, get into some of the nitty-gritty of his life. Who were his friends, and where was he when he was painting these paintings, and what effect might that have had? Which is not to say that, you know, there's any kind of direct correspondence between what he was doing and what he painted, but I do think it's really important to know the stories of some of our most influential artists. I hope that the book has kind of been able to give that sort of texture to his life.
Mm-hmm. I really like that line you included in the introduction from Anthony Burt's review of a Gordon Walters 2018 biography about how focusing on intricate refinement of art leads us to throwing a blanket over the fires that produced it. I think that's such a beautiful and so poignant. It's so poignant to what you were saying in that corridor as well. I think you kind of open on the notion that you kind of, you know, you really can't separate the art and the artist as many had done to Tony Fomerson. Do you think that's true for most or like kind of all art?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. I definitely think it's true for Tony, but I can't say whether it's true for, you know, all artists, because I don't know other artists as well as I know him.
True.
But I do, having spent so much time with his art and his life, I really feel, and he would have, he never thought they could be separated. You know, he thought, it was kind of partly what was happening at the time in the 70s and 80s and I guess it's sort of a consequence of modernism, which was that you can separate and should separate the art from the artist. Mm. And one of the things I think the effects that has is that it gives curators and galleries sort of a gatekeeping effect to the art, because they're the only ones who can comment on it.
Yeah.
And that's not a denigration of their role at all. I think it's really important. But I do think, I mean, like you, I've never been, you know, fully in the art scene. And there can sometimes be, it can be quite an intimidating place to be a part of.
Oh, totally.
Go on.
I was going to say the vocabulary of the art world is quite like alienating. You know,
yeah.
If you go to a gallery, there's all these big fancy words that describe pretty simple meanings and understandings.
Yeah. And I guess for me, I sort of see art as a bit like music. You know, there are people who can talk about music technically, and that's important and helpful. But for me, I just kind of like, oh, I really like that song, and it's the same with art. I really like that piece of art. I can't quite say why. Mm. I can't necessarily put words to it, but it just does something to me. You know, it kind of gives me some kind of jolt of recognition about something in my past or whatever. And that's what Tony's art did for me, and that's what started me on the story. Mm. Wanting to find out more about the man who created the art. And wanting it to go a bit wider than just people who were in the art scene. I hope that people in who are part of the art world enjoy the book. And I know that, you know, all the painters I spoke to were especially helpful. I think they're a little less encumbered by some of the big words and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I wanted it to be something that's quite readable and accessible while not shying away from the scholarship aspect of it, because I did want it to be a really well-researched book.
Yes, and it's been a decade doing the research, so
you'd hope it'd be good. That's right.
There's a really interesting moment in the first chapter where you describe Tony's mother disagreeing with many things that he said about his childhood, including how I think he was medically isolated from his family as an infant because he couldn't digest food properly and he was in hospital for ages. You know, how do you deal with the kind of fickleness and frailty of memory? And how many similar stories of exaggeration did you encounter when creating this book?
I can't remember how many, but that is, I guess, a problem I think that any biographer faces, yes, whether they acknowledge it or not. Because when you're talking to people, as you'll know, you know, if you ask friends about a given event, there'll be a whole lot of different takes on it. And I mean, you only have to listen to court proceedings, yeah, you know, and people questioning witnesses to know that memory can be fickle. Having said that, so I guess the book kind of acknowledges that and how we need to be careful when we're listening to memories. But I do think it's possible, the more and more people you talk to and the more assessment and weighing up you do, you can get closer to the truth of who someone was. So I don't think it's kind of like, you know, we can never know the core of someone, but I do think there are problems, and we just need to acknowledge that, be aware of them, and do our best to work towards knowing someone. I mean, you know, you think of if someone was doing a biography of a family member of yours, there would be so many different takes on that according to whether it was you remembering it, or a friend or a colleague, you know, acquaintances. It would all be quite different. But I think all of that put together helps us get closer to who a person is.
Mm-hmm, totally. In chapter 2, Tony goes to art school in is it Elam? Elam in Christchurch?
Elam. Elam is the one up here.
Yeah, yeah, they always confuse me, eh?
And I know, it's
he struggles with, like, oil painting and, I guess, adhering to the orthodox, old-fashioned ways of the art school. And there's an anecdote of, you know, Roman lettering not leaving the school as a subject to the late 60s, which really, you know, kind of portrays how old-school this art school is. What effect did that kind of orthodoxy have on his art practice when he was kind of just, you know, forming his own style? Did it reify his kind of outsiderness or, like, perceived otherness?
Yeah, that's a good observation. I think that it probably did. I think, you know, he didn't do particularly well at art school. He was, by the end of it, I think he got a C grade for his 3-year diploma, and he applied to do honours, but he was rejected. Or not rejected, but turned down. And he said it was because his art was a bit derivative. Which is all very funny when you think of the fact that he became probably, arguably, one of our most original painters ever. Mm. I think you're right. I think he was kind of, he later reflected on art school and said, nah, I didn't really learn anything. It wasn't very helpful. And he always encouraged young artists to not necessarily go to art school. He said, oh, you don't need it. And it was because, as you said, he liked this kind of outsider persona, which he cultivated.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that art school, with its quite restrictive sort of curriculum and so on, I think he was kicking against that. One of his most influential teachers was Rudy Gopaz. And he didn't quite fit the mold of a teacher at that time. And he was influential on a lot of key artists in New Zealand. And Gopaz really wanted Tony to kind of cut loose from his very careful way of drawing. and try to find the emotion in a piece. And Tony got really frustrated because he was used to just drawing slow, detailed kind of works. But he did break out of it, and he did say that it was quite an important moment for him, this sort of freeing up of his style.
Were a lot of New Zealand art schools like that back in the 60s, late 50s? Were they all kind of quite rigid, quite, you know, old school conservative around, you know, what kind of art
I think they were generally, and they were starting to move towards a more contemporary way of teaching. I know that I'm not an expert, but from the reading I've done, I know that things started to shift towards more of an Auckland focus in about the 60s and 70s, and a lot of artists moved up to Auckland from Christchurch, whereas Christchurch had been like the centre of the art world up until then.
I did not know that. I had no idea.
Yeah.
Far out. You know, there's a really interesting piece in here about Tony's mother kind of coming across his diaries, which chronicled his misadventures and drug abuse in Europe during the 60s, and she was so horrified that she burnt them all. Do we know a great deal of the material from those diaries, or are they kind of just like the great Library of Alexandria, you know, lost to history completely?
Unfortunately, that we don't know a lot. All I know is that they were the diaries of what went on for him mostly in Europe. And as you say, that was a lot to do with his addictions. He was suicidal at that point and tried to OD, but was not successful. So it was a really, really low point for him. And so I think possibly that's some of what was in the diaries. I'm not sure whether it contained also later stuff from his life in the 70s and 80s. But yeah, unfortunately, it's just one of those things as a biographer, you have to go, oh, it would have been really interesting to have that material, but we don't have it. I mean, I did get to talk to Mrs. Thomason, Mary, three times down in Christchurch at the home where Tony had grown up. So I did get a sense of Tony from her, and I got a sense of her and what sort of a person she was. Incredible woman. You know, she was in her 90s when I talked to her. Yeah. Very strong.
97 awesome. Or something?
Yeah, yeah. So there was that, but it was it was intriguing knowing or thinking about what might have been in those diaries.
Well, it seems like they had a very complicated relationship. You know, how would you characterize it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it possibly was complicated. I think she was incredibly supportive of him when she was reflecting on him back in the 90s.
Yeah.
She acknowledged, you know, who he had been as an artist, but she was also very aware of, you know, the demons that had kind of he had faced, and she said that he had had a tough life and he'd made some bad choices, as a mother would. So there was kind of it was quite moving, actually, at times to listen to her reflect on the life of her son. With that complicated sort of mixture of love and a disappointment, I suppose, which is quite common in any parental relationship.
Totally, yeah. Well, there's all this and much, much, much more in this huge book. I mean, it's like 400 pages. It's, you know, you definitely get your money's worth with this thing.
I have to say, Zach, I really enjoyed this conversation because, you know, you've engaged really closely with the book, and that's really encouraging as an author. So thank you.
No worries. If people want to buy this book, it's published by the Auckland University Press. You can get it at their website. Is it available at, like, your Whitcalls Paper Plus?
Yeah, so it is. It should be Whitcalls Paper Plus and all independent bookshops. So what's the key one in Dunedin?
I guess the University Bookshop is pretty popular.
Yeah, they would have it.
Cool. You know, it's funny. This is something I think I've talked to a few authors about. But every time I go to the airport and see their, like, top reads, you know who's always in there? Is Xi Jinping. Right. His books about China.
Is that right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's
funny, yeah.
Well, maybe we'll have to get this one to the airport.
For sure. Thank you so much for your time. I hope you have a great morning and that you have more time with your dogs.
Cheers. Thanks, Jack.
Thank you very much. All right, folks, that was Mark Forman. We're chatting about his new biography on Tony Fomerson, which you can find all over the place. It's called Life of the Artist, and the cover is a very, very striking image of Tony, probably the strongest image in the whole book. There's a reason why it's on the cover. We're going to play a little bit of Waxahachie, as requested by Mark, and then at 9:30 we should have the surf report. So here's Waxahachie with Right Back to It. You're listening to The One. Keep it locked.
That was a Radio 1 91 FM podcast. You can find more of them at r1.co.nz/podcasts.